So you've called because you have a story to read on tonight's show, Memo of the Air. KNYOLP Fort Bragg, KMECLP Ukiah. Sorry, I need to say that at some point.
Yeah, and after I posted you the link, I realized the story's very short, just 5 minutes. So if you'd like, you don't have to, but if you'd like, I have another very short story to read.
You do what you like. You read a couple of stories? Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. First one is called The Little Match Boy. Note, this brief tale is derived from Hans Christian Andersen's original piece, The Little Matchbook Girl. It was terribly chill with a thick Pacific fog. Rain pelted like bullets, and the sky was almost pitch. Nighttime approached, the last dark shade of the year. In the Stygian dank, a poor young man in a soaked-through hoodie and wet denims and ragged old running shoes he found on a doorstep was meandering the streets of the Castro. In the bitter morning air, when he had departed from Martin de Porres's free oatmeal breakfast, he had Zoris on, but what good did they serve? They had a very large footprint, way too awkward for him, for they were procured from an old drunk Mexican lying in the gutter. The lonely young fellow had lost them running across Mission Street, where a muni bus had rumbled by in great haste. One Zari he failed to regain, and a mongrel had scooted away with the other for a chew toy. And so the handsome waif plodded on with bare feet, which were freezing crimson until he found those sneakers. In his left coat pocket, he carried two spare books of matches, sealed in a baggie, along with one stashed in his shirt that he used to offer a light to anyone rummaging for his Bic. This was his way of striking up a conversation and hopefully finding a warm place and body for the night. But no one had accepted a light all day long, and no one had given him solace. Trembling with cold and loneliness, he wandered throughout the Castro, an image of destitution, a sad young man. The raindrops fell on his scraggly black hair, which cascaded in matted locks over his neck. In all the homes, Christmas tree lights glittered through windows, and there was a delightful scent of homemade meals and dessert, for it was New Year's Eve. Yes, he longed for a full belly and companionship. On Collingwood Street, across from the park, he sat down on a doorstep and drew up his rain-drenched legs. He grew colder and colder, but did not dare move on, for he had found not a single kind soul to take him in that day, and despair sank into his bones like an old, dying man. His hands were numb with cold. Oh, how much one kind hug from a gentle man might warm his soul. If he could only meet a friendly gay comrade to offer a match, and be swept up in his arms and taken home to a hot meal and a warm bed. He grew feverish and began to hallucinate. A ghostly male of kind and sweet demeanor approached him and asked for a light. The stranded boy's heart leapt for joy, and he withdrew a matchbook and lit the Winston. The match sputtered like a Roman candle to imbue his sudden companion's face like an angel. Had he finally found his one true love who would heal his every wound and keep him safe and happy forevermore? The man's gray eyes sparkled, and his smile warmed the wanderer's grieving soul like a gas flame heart. I must mention here that the young straggler's name was Seth, and he was just 17. Quite the gorgeous dude, though barely 5'4". He was a very good man, though a refugee from a broken family out of Montana. He never messed with hard drugs or alcohol, though nonetheless could never find another homeless friend here in San Francisco who could fulfill his desperate need for camaraderie and trust. He often wished he was straight to increase those odds. The kind man's face glowed with compassion as Seth held the match to his cigarette, but it gave off a weird flame. It really appeared to the lost boy as if he was sitting before God's judgment and was deemed innocent. How wonderful Seth felt in the warmth of this man's smile. His heart beat with fulfillment. The young man gazed up at his companion with reverence as a warm rush of happiness brushed away the last vestige of cold from every cell in his body. But then the match snuffed out, the man vanished, and Seth found himself once more shivering in the icy wet as he sat alone on a doorstep with no destiny. He struck another match, hoping to restore that vision. It shimmered intensely, and when the light fell upon the wall behind him, it became transparent like glass, and he could look beyond and into the dining room. On the table, a holiday linen was spread, and on it rested a bountiful array of roasted vegetables, turkey, ham, loin pork, and lasagna. The dishes seemed to glow with a supernatural luminosity as they tempted Seth to reach through the windows to enjoy a feast beyond any he has ever known. But the match blew out, and only the thick, cold wall loomed before him. He ignited a second match, whence he found himself seated beneath a glimmering Christmas tree radiant with gold and silver ornaments. It was much more grand and lovely than the one he had viewed last Christmas through the doorway of Grace Cathedral. Myriad LEDs lit the pine branches, and miniature gilt icons like those in Ukrainian art museums danced like sprites before his wondering eyes. Seth extended both arms in their direction. Then the second match went out. But the Christmas lights grew more intense. He now viewed them as bright stars in the heavenly vault. One of them descended like a shooting star and left behind a trail of sparks. Now someone has died, thought the forgotten boy, for his kindly grandmother, the only person who ever loved him and accepted him unconditionally the moment he confessed his gay desires, but who passed away 2 years ago, had taught him that whenever a star descends to earth, a soul goes up to God. He struck yet a third match against the Edwardian structure, and in the flaming light his grandmother appeared in a pale cerulean gown and with wings that touched the sky. "Grandma," cried the child, "bring me home. I fear you will vanish when the match burns out. You will disappear like the sweet man who asked me for a light and the ginormous New Year's dinner and that amazing Christmas tree." He desperately extracted the two other matchbooks and struck the whole bundle, for he yearned to keep his grandmother in his sight. The matches flamed with such intensity they surpassed daylight. His beloved grandmother had never before appeared so gracious. She embraced Seth warmly in her arms, and they flew as one beyond this troubled world to where there was neither hatred, loneliness, starvation, nor a God without compassion. But on that Collingwood doorstep rested the young man Seth with a peaceful visage and calm repose, dead from pneumonia, and the heartless reception of gay homeowners who've never known the blight of alienation nor its consequent outcome. The New Year's sun shone upon a good man who never knew love, homeless and rejected. He sat there, numb and frozen, holding the matchbooks, of which not a single match remained unlit. He wanted to warm himself, Castor residents declared, to appease their own guilt. Not a one gave any thought to this man's compassionate dreams of love and friendship, and how gladly his soul departed at last to find peace in the shade of his grandmother's wings. Now, second story is called Saint Eugene and the Abundant Well, a parable for the 21st century. Once upon a time, there was a village in the desert that grew to metropolis size. But while it was still a village, it experienced its first serious drought in the fourth year of recorded history. Before the drought, they never conserved water. After the drought, they did. Since 1 AD, after the drought, despite the corrective safeguard of separate family wells linked with pipes to the great well, thus meted and measured, there were some who grew too conservative, even in times of abundant rain. Ishmael was one of them. Now, Ishmael was surrounded by generous neighbors. As a matter of fact, the whole town was a union of generous neighbors, even Ishmael, until the devil planted a bad seed in his heart. It was in the year of the brimming wells, following the great rain, a time when all people need not be concerned about lack of water, that the seed of avarice stirred in Ishmael's bosom. "Since we are each allotted one wellful of water per month, whether drought or abundance, we must always plan and count our water use carefully, so as not to become a burden to our neighbors," thought Ishmael. "But," he continued, raising a finger to an imaginary accomplice, "if I can find an unquestioned excuse to take water from a neighbor for the first 2 weeks of every month, I will have so much water that I'll need never conserve." So Ishmael set his plan to task. Coming up with an ironclad excuse was tough, one that no one would question, hence never bring to the attention of the water priests. But choosing a victim among his many generous neighbors took no more time than the flip of a fly's wing. Ishmael's eyes lit up. "Eugene, the town fool, of course." Eugene, the town fool, was born happy and remained that way. No one ever knew why he laughed so much, so they wrote it off to mental retardation and put him on Social Security. Eugene took everyone at their word and therefore was the perfect dupe for Ishmael's devious scheme. At the time of Ishmael's plan, a species of large frog was migrating across the desert territory, occasionally clogging some of the irrigation pipes that connected the great well to individual wells. Though it never took more than 2 days to clear any number of frogs and their eggs from a conduit they currently occupied, it was common during those months for neighbors with unplugged lines to provide some water to those whose wells were stopped. Hence, Ishmael was assisted in his scheme by a freak of nature. So it was easy for him to convince Eugene that his well was indeed glutted with frogs. Eugene, of course, never questioned Ishmael's daily requests for water, not even when his own well was but a quarter full by the 15th of the month. By the second month, the seed in Ishmael's heart had taken root in the hearts of his neighbors. But Eugene never questioned their motive, even though his well was only an eighth full by the 15th. By the third month, the entire village, except the water priests, was knocking on Eugene's door every day, and Eugene's well was down to only a bucketful by the 15th. Meanwhile, Ishmael gloated over the abundance of water now in his well so that he could splash away to his heart's content, heedless to the other villagers' use of Eugene's well or to the probability of Eugene dying of thirst. Needless to say, everyone acted like Ishmael at this point, except the town fool, of course. This continued month after month, and Eugene laughed through it all, ladling a bucket of water for anyone who knocked. Even when down to only a bucketful, his well still provided enough water to meet everyone's needs, including his own. A year had passed since the advent of Ishmael's scheme, but no one had yet stopped to wonder why Eugene's well never ran dry. But Eugene kept chuckling, knowing full well that the day would come when everyone must acknowledge the miracle of his well and from whence the water came. The end. So, those were the two tales.
That's
are you there?
Yeah, they're different from the other stories that you generally write.
Uh-huh. Well, what the impression you got from my stories are not how I generally write.
I see.
So I thought I'd give you a taste of those some of my other style.
Those are not new stories. Those are like, how old are those?
The second one was 1997, and the first, this, and The Little Match Boy was 2014. I write in different styles.
Yeah, I see that.
Yeah, yeah. And there's going to be some more new ones coming down the line very soon that are going to be different than the news autobiographical style. But there'll be more of those too.
Are you writing as much now as you used to, or?
Well, no. I have tons of outline stuff and ideas, and so it's not really a dry spell. That's just how I come and go in waves, because I'm usually distracted by what I consider more important than my writing, which is, you know, having being involved with the homeless scene and writing about it, or just observing and later on writing about it, letters to the editor or things on Facebook and stuff, which then gives me inspiration. But it does stretch me and wipe me out, and it's like very exhausting to the point where I just have to write down an outline or ideas for stories, which I'll get around to later on. I have a whole folder on my hard drive of ideas. You know,
I saw the video that you sent me a link to of you, because you heard me say something about wondering about the living situation that you have, because you talked about it.
Oh, yes, of my the little tour of my building.
You took a little tour with the video tour of your hallways and that interesting sort of air shaft back porch with the stairways made out of toothpicks that you have to pick your way down, and the garbage cans in the middle of the bottom and the back. And the door. I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's an eerie building. It's poorly maintained. Built in 1904, so, you know, it survived the big one, of course. And the lights used to be just 20 watts years ago. It was very dim and gloomy, and you had a lot of druggies in the building. And now it's like living in the dead zone. You know, it's so damn quiet. There's nobody around. Hardly anyone's walking through the hallway.
Headed through the hallway, and you were, I could hear as you were going by some of the doors, there was music playing behind one of the doors. And
that's the neighbors. Those are the people who where my neighbor Michael died all of a sudden, and they're the same people there, young people, and they're a little noisy, but not bad. I find them to be very shallow, you know, just kind of party type, and like so many people around here, just, you know, zombies, people without souls. You know, they give you a smile, but there's nothing there, and it's really quite an unhappy contrast to friendly Michael.
He's dead.
He's
dead now.
Yes, he's dead, I guess. I have to take the word for it. I have to take the manager's word for it. He just put up a note one day and said, this is a shock, he died all of a sudden. Don't know why or how.
Maybe they sold him to a secret government lab where they're experimenting on him and making his skin thick in order to make him a super soldier.
Well, I was thinking it was maybe he was doing some B&B deals. Not B&B, Airbnb. To share rental to make money. I think he was doing that. I think maybe they poisoned him, you know, and took over or something.
Or it might be something even creepier than that.
Well, this is a very creepy building, and it has quite a creepy history. I'm going to write about some of those.
You've been living there for a long time. Have they raised your rent in all the time you've been living there, or is it the same because it's under some sort of control?
Well, two things. It's under rent control, but it did get raised. Well, it did get raised before it was rent control, not very much, all right? But when it hit rent control, and then we had me and 12 other people had a lawsuit, very justifiable lawsuit, against the landlord. They were going to remove some of the work in front of the building because of asbestos, and they covered it with this huge shroud over this building. They said it was only going to be 2 weeks. So it went on for months, and so we started
processing. You mean they sealed in the asbestos dust, and you're still living in the building?
Yeah.
This
is a very corrupt city, especially when it comes to landlords and stuff. And so there was a lawsuit, and scaffolding was all around the building for all these months, and they would never lower the boards from the first level, so you had street people come up and climb around and knock in the windows or sleep there. It was fucking scary.
Really?
I had all
my That's an attractive nuisance, they call that in the law. Attractive nuisance.
Really? I don't find any of that attractive.
No, it's like they use that to sue somebody for building a like they put up somebody puts up a piece of art in the park, and a child climbs up on it and falls off and breaks his neck, and so they sue them because
because
the art is it's attractive to somebody to come and climb on it.
Yeah, I was thinking from my perspective. No, I get it. From the street person was attracted. And
you're
then,
on the second floor or the third floor?
Second floor.
So they could easily climb up. Street people could easily climb up and climb in your window because of the scaffolding.
Yeah, so I had my furniture pushed up against the windows. So I'd have a chance to fight back if I need to.
Oh, my God. So barricades. You've made a barricade of the IKEA things.
Yeah. Well, I got $14,000 out of it, but the people I had to join with the lawsuit, well, they needed me, because I was a good witness, but they hated me. They were very nasty people.
Why did they hate you?
Most of them gay. Well, I've been hated here for years because
I
don't know.
They're gay, and so shouldn't you, aren't you gay?
Yeah.
So, I mean, not the
but
same
it's
kind
a
of gay?
Thing. These are people with money sitting around, and they...
Oh, I see. Okay, I got it.
Okay. Yeah, and gossip spread. Well, the manager, he was a budding lawyer, and he opened up an law office in the building, which is illegal, too. You're not allowed to open a business in the building. Someone asked him, and I found out. He said, well, it was grandfather law. We can do it. But anyways, he gossiped to the other people, saying, I'm paying really low rent, and get people... This one guy who moved in to get a job, you know, for... an internet stuff, IT job. He was marching down the hall one day. Says it's horrible what low rent some people have to pay and have to pay. You know,
he just
moved here. You know, a year ago, and he's acting arrogant. And he went. Sometimes he say he knocked on the door. And said, did you leave this in the back porch? And it was a can that wasn't empty. A can of rotting soup or something. I said, no, I washed myself. I'm very clean. You know, and just assholes like that. And they were the ones, you know, brought me in a lawsuit, and they wanted me to shut up and do what they say. And they resented that. And I knew they resented so much that I was going to get the same amount they were, because they're such upstanding, loyal citizens. And they get a good paying job, and they pay through the nose for rent here. And I only pay, you know, $300 a month or whatever it was back then, you know. So, because the original amount was supposed to be $45,000 for each of us, because it was quite an offense, and it was just about would be the lawyer said that is the going rate, something like this. But certain people moved. It went on for almost 3 years. You know, we had to wait, and some people got tired, and we had got together at one of the meetings, and they looked at me and said, yeah, we're getting $45,000 for you, and you better not accept anything less. You know, it was like a threat. I will kill you, right? We'll kill you. So then when some people got tired of waiting, they were willing to accept a lot less. Some moved and were waiting, or I don't know. So they all agreed, without consulting with me, to $14,000. So we went to the next meeting with the lawyer, and I found it out. They were looking at me after they had, like, threatened to kill or maim me, for saying I'll accept lower than $45,000. Here I'm in the situation that I now they want me to accept $14,000, and what am I supposed to do about that? Well, I made them wait a few weeks, felt out, so I said, okay, $14,000, because everyone else, you know, would get caved in. Well, the thing is, the reason they hated so much the idea of my getting that much money, $45,000, they would have preferred to sell out for a lot less just so I wouldn't get it. Really, really nasty. So part of the agreement was that as long as we remain living here, they can't raise our rent. So under rent control, they could still raise it, you know, under rate of inflation, 1% or 2%. But this is funny. I just got a rent reduction starting this month. Just an $8 reduction, 2.5% reduction, because the elevator broke down, and it's been broken down for more than 3 months now.
Yeah, you told me about that. Did they break the elevator to cause trouble for you, or did it just break?
No. The elevator's an old one. They should have replaced it decades ago. It's the original one. I call it the birdcage.
The original elevator? You're talking about a metal cage elevator in a residential building, and it's the original...
Yes.
Wow.
And it's not disabled friendly, because the door is hard to swing open, and then you get a slide slide the grated door, you know, the collapsible door, and it's very hard. So even a able-bodied person with a package has to fight and struggle to get in and out.
How tall is the building? How tall is the building?
It's four stories high.
Oh, so the people on the fourth floor are the people who are discommoded by the elevator.
And the third, and there's one on the fourth and one on the third who one had surgery in it for his knees, the other one is very, very old, and they both have a very difficult time. Well, the elevator would break down maybe once every other year for years, you know, and they get it fixed within a few days. But lately, in the last 2 years, you know, it's expensive because you got to get, there's no, components pre-made. You had to have to make it by hand, you know, real old-fashioned stuff, 19th century shit, you know. So they had to get a special technician to make the parts and stuff. So it's expensive. So it started breaking down like once every few months to get back, and then like more often and more often until a few months ago it broke down, and the manager had arranged to have the whole elevator replaced last year, and I'm right next to it. Which meant they're going to have to go through all that banging and noise all day long. And, well, I'm gone in the day, but in the morning I have to deal with it because I have to shower, I have to brush my teeth, I have to eat my breakfast, and I have to go through that. So that's coming up eventually. But then, because of the bureaucracy, that didn't go through or something. I don't know the details. So this is what happened. Now, it finally broke down for good. And I only live on the second floor, and I never used the birdcage, so that's no big deal. And then there was each floor has a single room, and then the rest are just studios, one bedroom, two bedrooms. It's an old building, and buildings aren't made that way anymore. It's not an SRO hotel, thank God, you know. But so there's three single rooms in each floor, and so only three units share that bathroom down the hallway. Well, there was one guy when I moved in there. Who lived next to the bathroom, named Max. He was a little guy, about, I don't know, 4'8", Native American, smoked pot, not very bright. He was okay, but the people he brought over, drug dealers, druggies, they were not so nice. And I walked with a baseball bat down the hallway, you know, to use the restroom, because they sometimes would stand out there and
stare at me. What kind of bat do you like to use in a situation like that? Do you like the aluminum ones, or do you like the Louisville Sluggers that are made out of a real piece of wood?
Well, I'm not a baseball sports fan. I just had a wooden bat.
Like a wooden bat, like from
something
the...
I found on the street.
Uh-huh.
And so I was gone. I went down to Santa Cruz for a week. Oh, wait, what's longer than a week? Yeah, I went out camping and stuff. All right. And I came back, and it turned out Max had died. It was an overdose. Rumor has it he was intentionally overdosed because he had gotten an inheritance from a relative about, I don't know, $30,000.
Wow.
And what happened was no one knew he had died until the stink got, you know, horrific.
So this is on your floor?
Yes. So I was glad I was away through all that. And I was glad he was gone, too.
Yeah, it's hard.
I had two friends who lived in that building, so we held a little...
I'm curious about something. You say there's a bathroom at the end of the hall, and all of the apartments on the floor share that bathroom?
No, just three single units.
Ah.
That would be ridiculous if you think about it. All the apartments that share one bathroom.
I see.
Mine's a room, not an apartment. I know you call it an apartment on the air, but that makes it sound like I have a better situation.
No, I got it. I'm just trying to figure out what's... you showed me a picture of what it looked like going down the hall and going down the stairs, but what I'm wondering is, how do you take a shower or take a bath?
I turn on the shower, turn on the bath. What?
But it's in the bathroom. It's all...
Yeah.
Everything's in the bathroom. So
I put on
my
bathrobe
and
go to the
people,
bathroom.
How many people share that bathroom?
Three, including me.
Oh, well, that's not so bad. You could, you know, as long as you don't stay in there for a couple of hours and take a shower and, you know.
Yeah, but the thing is, you can't police people and tell them not to do that. So someone wants to slosh around, you know.
Suppose somebody's sick, you know.
Some guy thinks he's so hot and beautiful and wants to soak in there for 2 hours. It's crazy, you know.
So it's a shower bath then. You could use it for a shower, or you could sit in the bathtub.
Yeah, I just wish it was just a shower, not a bath, and that way we wouldn't have to deal.
I'd feel uncomfortable, you know, lying down in a bathtub, soaking in water in a bathtub that other people were using, you know, that I
But there's this one guy who thinks he's so hot, and, you know, and he's got to pamper himself in there, you know.
Well, you know, you don't know what his, he's probably got.
Yeah, but then I got to take a crap. What do? I have to use my waste basket in my bedroom, in my room.
I see. Yeah, you're right. That's not right. And then you've got plastic bags, you know, doggy bag plastic bags.
Yeah, I know. Well, what was so funny, when Michael, you know, my neighbor who died, when Michael read that story down out in San Francisco, and a couple of weeks later he said, you know, I mentioned the story that I bring the sealed bag out to a garbage bin right out front. He said, look, see, they moved the garbage bin down. They did, down to the corner. Oh, they're making it inconvenient for me. And then just recently, a few months back, they removed it for good. I said, oh, this is ridiculous. And I read in the news the next day that the reason they are reducing the number of public garbage bins is because residents are taking advantage of it and putting the garbage in there to save money on their own garbage fees. I said, well, I contributed to that, I guess.
Kind of. Sort of.
What choice did I have?
Well, I don't know. Is there a recycle bin?
Yeah, downstairs, yes.
There's a regular.
Put my poop in that.
No, you don't want to do that. That's not right. That it probably has a little picture on the side, a little, you know, one that circle with a line through it, and a picture of somebody putting a dog shit bag in.
That would be funny, but
don't
no, they
do
don't
that.
Have that.
No,
they
no
don't
doing
they,
that. No. All right, it's 1:30. It's 1:35. KNYOLP Fort Bragg, KMECLP Ukiah. Zeke, thank you for calling and reading your stories. That was fun. And
you're welcome, and thank you for having me. I was able to tune in at 12:30, so I heard the last 10 minutes or so of Alex.
I know you like him. He's hard not to like. He's a great guy.
Isn't he just wonderful? Wonderful storyteller and very personable and. I love a good conversationalist, and he's one of the best.
He's left-handed.
Really? So am I.
Okay, well, I'm left-handed, too. Great minds think alike.
I'm not completely left-handed. I throw and grip into my strong hand. I use my right hand for everything else. Otherwise, I do something like that.
Ping-pong either hand, bat, and play the guitar right-handed. All the food things, you know, cooking and eating with either hand is just as good.
With me it's left hand there.
Scissors, I have to use scissors with my right hand.
I'm a little bit more left-handed than you.
Yeah.
Okay, well, continue on with your wonderful show.
I'll be doing it, and I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks because I'll be back in Fort Bragg in a couple of weeks. Next week, I'll probably be doing the show from Juanita's place, so send me your story, and I'll read it then.
Okay, will do. Good night.
Good night.